Joining me today on the Culture Kitch, legendary guitarist, composer, and inventor, 90 years young and still kicking, Mr. Les Paul. Hi, welcome to the Culture Kitch. Joining me today is the legendary Les Paul. Not only a writer, but an inventor, songwriter, producer, maestro, rencontre, everything, and all the above, and the kitchen sink.
The sink. I recognize it.
You recognize it.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Les?
Good. Good.
Les, I understand that you got some of the biggest rock stars in the business together recently. To celebrate
sure
your music.
Sure did. It was exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah. How does a guy like you, who knows so little about the guitar,
find guys like Clapton, Jeff Beck?
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by the Steve Miller story, though. Tell me about Steve Miller and how you got involved with Steve Miller.
Well, Steve Miller was his father, George Miller, was best man at my wedding. And we stayed at his house that night, and little Steve had to go to the bathroom. The only bathroom is the room that we were in. And so he had to go through our room to get to the bathroom, and he had to go real bad. So he just about tore the door down to get through the room. And he whizzed past us, and Mary says, "What was that?" And I says, "I guess it's some guy had to go to the bathroom." And when the kid come out, here's this little kid. And he says, "Are you Mr. Paul?" I says, "Yeah." And he says, "Boy, I sure admire you, whatever." He was saying nice things. So I says, "Do you like the guitar?" And he says, "I sure do." And I says, "Well, I got one here. You want to play it?" So he picked it up and started to play it. And so I showed him some chords and things, and we started. He was like 4 or 5 years old, just a little kid. And he says, "Can I call you Les?" And I said, "Sure, you can call Steve. You can call me Les." So he's been calling me Les ever since.
One lesson in, and he was calling you Les. Did you give him any lessons after that, as he progressed?
Well, he used to come in the club a lot with his dad. His dad was a lover of the guitar. And a very good friend of ours, he and his mother, Bertha and George, were very dear friends. And so they came into the club a lot, and they would bring little Steve along, and little Steve would watch and see what we're doing, and want to grow up and be like us someday.
Well, he didn't do too bad. I mean,
he did very well.
I think he had a good teacher because, you had your string of hits, and Steve certainly had his string of hits.
Well, if he didn't have to go, he probably had never been a guitar player.
Well, you can help. Mother Nature intervened, I guess.
Yeah, that's the way it goes.
That's the way it goes when you got to go.
That's right.
Less of, in your early days, the electric guitar, what was the impetus for that creation, your guitars specifically?
Well, I guess the basic answer would be is that the guitar was an apologetic, timid instrument, and we wanted to make it something that was a pit bull. We wanted to make it so that it had a lot of authority and would no longer be the last guy you'd hire in the band, and make him more important. And to do that by making him electric, open the door to making all the different sounds that you can make today with a guitar. Well, that's what I wanted to do and did.
So obviously you had your own workstation at home, and you would play around with the pickups, the magnetics. Had anyone really been working with pickups in your mind to the extent that you really got into it?
I don't think there was anybody. There were several of them. There was Nat Daniels, who made a guitar, Dan Electro guitar. And I met him on Canal Street down about 1940.
Right.
And he seemed to know what he was doing. But there were very few in the early days that really knew what the pickup was all about and what it should do and how you should do it. And gradually there became more involved, and I don't know that too many know too much about it yet.
Well,
the guitar hasn't changed much, has it?
Well, it hasn't, nor have the pickups. And everyone seems, you know, as a guitar player myself, everyone seems to really value the older guitars with the older pickups. They always say that the pickups sound better, the woods were better, you know, just the whole all around.
It's basically the same. Really, it is.
Yeah.
Really, yeah. Well, if I get a 59, or well, this happens to be a 71 I got in my hands, but it doesn't matter. Whatever guitar I pick up, it sounds the same.
Well, that's because you know how to play it.
It's the player.
Right.
You know, guy. I think a great violinist could pick up a mediocre violin and get more out of it than a kid playing a Stradivarius.
A good point. Having said that, what was the first real big breakthrough then commercially for the guitar and the electric guitars, but your guitars?
Well, there were a lot of breakthroughs, but they came about gradually. The first thing was to make one. And then after I made one, I just took the receiver part of a telephone, which was all the work was already done for me by Bell Labs, and I had good partners at that time.
Right.
So anything I got involved with, I had a great respect for Bell Telephone and Bell Labs, and so they became an important part, and so did the radio, and so did the speakers and the whole works that go with it.
Well, how about working with, like, the luthiers? Were you working with the wood yourself as well and just trying different types of woods?
Oh, yeah. I tried. First thing I tried, I wanted to see the radical difference, and I wanted it to be radical so that you could see the big difference between a soft piece of wood and a piece of railroad track. Mm-hmm. And the railroad track was without a doubt the best of the bunch.
Really?
And it had such a sweet, wonderful, sustaining, clear sound. It did not add any problems like a piece of wood does. Mm-hmm. The wood starts to vibrate and cause its own thing. And it may be great and it may not be. The steel railroad track, it remained stable. And whether it was a hot day or a cold day, or whether all you had to do is put it on a horse and get a job singing with a piece of railroad track. that was a great idea to prove that the railroad track was the way to go, and to go somewhere close to that would be a solid body guitar.
Right.
And make it with a maple top on it and do those things, and it would be great.
Interesting. Well, I didn't know that piece of history. And then I guess all the other things you added, as you said, those other things, the inlays, the detailing, those things came later.
Gingerbread,
right.
Gingerbread, yeah. You don't need Gibson. The Gibson people and I had a long talk many years ago when Gibson was in Kalamazoo. We were flying over Lake Michigan, and we got to talking about it. And I said, the only way to do that is to buy a company like Epiphone and have it made offshore. And by doing that, would make it possible to make a more economical instrument. But the youngster or the beginner playing the guitar would have the advantage of having a very fine instrument,
right. Even
though it costs a lot less money. Leave the gingerbread off, because that's not going to make you play better,
right,
or anything else. It's just for looks. And of course, Gibson was very adamant about it. And for 6 years, they just sat on the plane. No way would we even consider such an idea. Well, it didn't take me but a year to get them to buy Epiphone, which they did. And when they bought Epiphone, then they said, what are we going to do with that? And I said, well, if you don't put anything out but rejects, at least you got a good name. Epiphone was a good name.
Right.
And they made a fine guitar, right, even though they didn't succeed.
Huh.
And so many years later, when Henry Jeskowitz took over Gibson, he and I went to dinner and discussed these problems. And about 6 years later, Henry started to move forward with the idea of making the Epiphone guitar, which is, by the way, is a darn good instrument. So I'm entertaining the idea that I'd be just as happy and probably make a lot of people happy if I played an Epiphone for a while.
You think you'd get an endorsement deal from those guys? I have an Epiphone. I love my Epiphone.
Yeah.
It's a terrific guitar.
It sure is.
Yeah, you know, you're right. If you leave off the gingerbread, I like that. May I use that in future discussions with friends?
Sure.
The gingerbread, I like that.
Sure.
As a songwriter competing with an orchestra, as you said, before the guitar was heard, now suddenly you're heard. That first time you finally had your guitar working for you, what was the first song you wrote?
They evolved at the same time. When I started playing the guitar and the harmonica, I wrote country songs, and some of them were recorded by big name artists. And then after that, I just kept progressing. And finally, when Mary and I started together in 49, I began to write on each song the opposite side I wrote. And so if you buy Via Condice, you got Johnny is the Boy for Me. You got How High the Moon, you got Walking and Whistling Blues.
Right.
So on the back of each hit, I wrote the other song.
Great.
And although the hit took away from my song, I wrote a lot of, I thought, some good songs. But
I would agree.
You know.
Yeah. You have a, you know, I've seen there's a compilation out as well right now, the Les Paul compilation, as well as the Rock and Roll Les Paul record, which is, you know, a long time coming, but I guess these things go in cycles.
It takes time.
Yeah.
It takes time.
All you youngsters out there, don't give up.
Yeah, you got 90 years to go.
What do they say? It takes 24 years to make your first record and 6 months to make your second?
I didn't hear that, but it's a good idea. Yeah, that makes sense.
What's your favorite song to play these days? What song do you never get tired of playing of the songs you've written?
Oh, it just depends upon what day it is and what we're doing. If that particular day, that song is the one that we concentrate on.
Right.
And that goes for hits, too. If we have a hit on How High the Moon, it's big for us as long as it's number one. When it's number two or three, then we're looking for the next one.
Ah.
And so it's World's Waiting for the Sunrise, so we go for that one.
All right.
And I was thinking of it last night. I was thinking a song comes along like Via Condias. It goes 10, 11, 12 million records. Back in those days, that was unheard of.
Oh.
And to have something that big, well, then Via Condias, of course, is the song that you favor.
Mm.
And of course your favorite, because that's the one you receive the most awards and the most money for.
Right.
But not necessarily does it remain in your mind as if that's the greatest song.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that I think are great, probably the public wouldn't want to even be caught dead listening to.
For example?
Well, an example would be like if I wrote a song called Teresa, and it's a very, very, very intricate piece of material, but It never went anywhere, so I just assumed that isn't what the people are looking for. So I didn't go that way. If I write another song, like to my surprise, How High the Moon was not number one when we got to London, England. We're going to play the Palladium, and on the signboards when we got off the Queen Mary and we're looking at the signboards, Les Paul and Mary Ford, Walking and Whistling Blues. And that was the hit song in England.
Over there, right.
Over there. Yeah. And didn't even have it in my library.
Wow.
Didn't even bring the music. Never thought that.
Had to make those guys behind you learn it, huh?
Yeah. it's interesting to see just what the public really knows what they want to hear.
Yeah, and like the nights I've been here too, the people, the requests they yell out. Sometimes they catch you off guard. You'll say, "Geez, we haven't done that one in a while."
That's right. Yeah. So we do it.
Yeah.
That's the fun in it. You do it, and then you add it to your library and go from there.
I've got a question to frame it out bigger. Thinking visually, what artist, painter, sculptor represents the Les Paul sound? If you had to say, you know, I think of my music in a visual term. Is there an artist you identify with? No? How about in literature? Are you an avid reader? Do you read a lot of the classics? Do you like contemporary fiction?
I read what I need to read to get to answer to my question. Now, if it happens to be with certain types of rubber, I would get deeply involved in rubber. If I'm dealing with the vibration of a string, I'll go over there and I will do what I have to do. But I won't read the whole book and get involved in that. If
right.
I want to read about President Roosevelt in 1939, that's when I met him.
Wow.
And that's when I played for him. I would, of course, be very interested in reading as to just what made him tick in 1939, because I was right there, and what he did and why he did what he did.
Right. You witnessed it firsthand, so you want to continue with it.
Yeah, and I would read about that, but I would, if I had to read everything about Roosevelt that there is, I'd be there night and day for a million years.
Right.
There's so much to read. It reminds me of Edison when Tom Edison said, "Buy me a home," he said to his lawyer. And he says, "Anything special you want?" He says, "Yeah, I'd like a library full of books." And he says, "Well, what books do you want?" He says, "I don't care. Just have it full of books." Hmm. And when you go to Tom's library and you look, you'll find certain books where he underlines certain bits of information that he wants, and the rest of the book he didn't look at.
Interesting. Interesting. So do you have a large library then of everything?
I have a ton of stuff.
Right.
And when I specifically go to my library, I go there because I got a problem.
Right.
And I want to go there and solve the problem. So I go there and don't go on a tangent and start reading a book and find out about something else that has nothing to do with where I originally went in to get.
Right.
And so I read that way. Sometimes I get sucked in on a good book, with Humphrey Bogart or something like
right.
that, and want to read about him or someone.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's the side of the artist many people don't see. People just assume that you do music 24/7, you know.
And no.
This other world beyond that veil.
Yeah. We just do what I have to do.
The youngsters out there, the kids starting out, they're inundated with so much information today, and maybe they're thinking about a career in music. They have so many advantages today for learning.
They have all the advantages that we didn't have, for sure. I look back and I say, if I wanted a pick, there was no place to get a pick, and so I just took the last key off the piano. So you'd always know, wow, if you walk into a joint, you see the last key missing, you say, well, Les played here.
That's great. That's a great piece. I had no idea.
Yeah, that's where I get my picks. But
so they were ivory?
The ivory pick.
The ivory pick. Mm-hmm.
But that went for almost everything. We just didn't have a music store. We just didn't have the great advantage that the fellow has today. He can go down and look at it, he can see it, he can slow it down, play it frontwards, backwards. It's written out for him, and it can be explained. It's a down pick, it's an up pick. You pull it, you hammer it, you know. You slide, whatever you're gonna do, it's all worked out for you. And if you don't like that way, they'll give you an alternative of two or three other ways of doing it. But they say, this is what Eddie Lang did here, and this is what Django did there, and that's the way it is. You buy the book and learn it firsthand.
Right, right. Or the DVD.
Yeah, sound, picture, anything you wish, sure.
Speaking of Django, who were your favorite players coming
up? Well, Django was one of them. Eddie Lang was the one that both Django and I, we had a long talk about it, and that's what turned him on, that's what turned me on. So we both were listening to the same person.
Interesting. And how about the contemporary guys, you know, the guys the last 30 years or so who have paid so many tributes to you sonically, in the press, etc. Who do you fancy?
There's so many. I know I'd miss 30, 40 of them if I began to tell you, but I would just say that there's so many rules been broken as to what you should do and what you shouldn't do when you're playing the guitar. And there's so many new creative things that are done since it's been amplified that I just think it's great with so many of the great pickers out there. There are some that, you know, that's why they got the knob on the radio, is because if you don't like it, you can turn it, go somewhere else. But basically, there's some very, very fine players out there.
How about the acoustic guys? How about a guy like Doc Watson?
I love them. Love them, sure. Yeah. I don't care whether they pick it with their teeth. It doesn't matter as long as they have something to say and get the message across.
They have the soul and passion behind the music.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's terribly important that they do break the rules. And they say, well, this is the way I learned from my grandfather on the back porch or whatever it is. And it's great. It's great that they all go their own way and create new things and better things.
Yeah, that's good advice. Don't be boxed in. Don't be boxed in. How about the new technologies? I see that you guys employ a lot of that when you're taping the shows, Pro Tools and, you know, hard disk recorders and everything. Do you see any room for improvement in those areas? Are you working on anything?
Oh, my goodness. It's full of things that yet have to be done and are missing from the way. When I invented the multi-track machine, I knew it was going to have its place in the world. I didn't know it was going to be so awesome, so big, so gigantic. But I'm very glad to see that. I'm very glad to see them come so advanced so quickly. But there are certain things that you hear with the analog you don't hear with the digital. And there's certain things that are yet to be desired that you hear with one and not with the other.
Right.
So both are complementary, and at this time, we choose to use both.
When you're at home, do you listen to the record player, or do you listen to the CD, or both?
You wouldn't believe what I listen to. At home, I listen to a kitchen radio, a simple radio, which is non-professional, as far away from being critical. When I go to the studios, which I have throughout my house, I have different rooms with different purposes.
Right.
that's when I get into critical listening. Now I have the finest speakers, the finest of everything, and it's like having a magnifying glass and really focusing in on your best friend. I think you'd rather go on a good drunk.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, I think that's what happens with great speakers. And if you really want to get critical,
right,
then you have to have this very critical equipment that's going to show all the things wrong as well as right. And it's not always enjoyable. Sometimes the kitchen radio is much more enjoyable because you don't hear all the flaws. You just get a general picture of it, and you listen to the message, and you listen to it like a layman.
Well, is that, for some of my contemporaries, that's the argument. Pro Tools has made it so perfect that you lose the passion and the performance, and that the old analog days that you would just do a number of takes and pick one you like, because someone's always going to make a mistake.
Yeah. And then there's Pro Tools, and then there's others that are completely the opposite of Pro Tools. And
right.
And they have their advantages too. So you want to go both ways, you want to go three different ways, four different ways,
right.
And there is no right way, never will be.
But still mixing to that one single mono speaker, it always comes down to that, doesn't it? You hear the separation and...
I do.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody else does, but I do.
There's some engineers that still do that. They'll mix down and they'll say, if it sounds good on a single mono source, it's got to sound good on a stereo source. It seems logically that makes sense to me, maybe.
Well, that, you could get into this one for another 10 hours. I agree with you on the thought that I would rather hear it on mono and get the message, and that's fine. Because as soon as you start going to more than one source, it's where one person or several persons decide that we're going to put this over here, that over there, and that over there. We may not like that or want that. Okay.
Right.
And that goes the same for when you're making the recording, whether you want to start there and place each person on the stage before they're recorded and go anywhere.
Right.
Are they positioned right on the stage to begin with? And then are you going to give us that exact reproduction of that?
Yeah.
And would you like that if you got it?
Well, I guess maybe we're getting to that where you'll be able to virtually choose what you have in the mix. And you'll say, we only have two ears. Most people are able to hear out of both ears. And, I think they've tried all these different formats, quadraphonic sound and surround sound and everything. But you're still listening to a signal typically that's coming to two.
It's interesting. We have two ears. But to reproduce that sound of what you're hearing with the two ears, you'd probably need a dozen mics placed around your head, because I'm hearing a noise coming from behind me. I'm hearing things coming the side of me. If you were designing Carnegie Hall, would you design it with the seats empty or with the audience there? And how old is the audience? Are they all bald-headed? Are they wearing tuxedos with stiff shirts on? The reflections, it goes on and on
right.
and on. You go absolutely crazy.
Right,
with it, okay? And of course, now they just run up some great big stack of speakers, turn them up wide open, and go.
Well, at Carnegie Hall, you got to turn it down to hear, right? Because it's acoustically pretty good, I think.
Oh, well, I remember the old days, 50, 60 years ago, where Carnegie Hall was a dream. And, of course, if you go in there today, it could be a terrible nightmare.
Right.
Because there you are with just stacks of speakers. And it depends upon where you're sitting in that room. You could be sitting right next to a big subwoofer.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Yeah.
Just removing all the fillings in your teeth. Who knows?
I mean, it's funny you should say that because it's true. Oftentimes you go to a rock concert and you see these guys, they sound check, and they've sound checked to an empty room. And then, you know, the crowd starts to come and they've started their thing, and suddenly, you know, a comfortable level becomes an uncomfortable level sonically. And you're thinking, okay, well, what's this? And the guy's mixing with headphones on now. He's not even hearing what the rest of the house is hearing, perhaps.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. There's so many subtleties and shades of the mix.
Yeah, yeah.
And live performance. How about, did you get to decide on the mix for your rock record, your new rock record?
Partially, yeah. Partially.
Was that fun?
Yeah, it was very, very much so. It was fun just hearing my friends play their own individual thing.
Right.
They had a choice of doing anything they wished. And so they could pick their own songs, they could direct their own group, pick their own people to work with, and play it the way they wished to play it. But at the same time, it was a privilege to hear each individual say what he had to say.
Right.
So Jeff Beck got up there and says, well, here's what I'm going to do.
Right.
So this is his one chance. He may not want to do that on his own record.
Right.
Because he's got a company that says, well, here's how we believe.
Ah.
Right? And they believe entirely different. They think that considering what he did last, what he did here, what he did there, who's against him on the charts, all the things that they have to analyze and say, no, 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 here's the song you should do, okay? And they may be 100% right, they may be 100% wrong. In this particular case, this isn't the reason for the record. The reason for the record is they can say, Les, here's what I'd like to play for you, and then they go play it.
That's beautiful.
So it may not be at all what Edgar Winter wants in his album.
Right.
Okay, but he always wanted to play that song. Now he's got a chance to do it, so he does it.
Well, that's great that you gave him that kind of creative, poetic license.
Yeah,
with you.
Free to do what they wish to do, and I didn't produce it either. I let them produce it because I said, no, we're in another world. Right. We're over in rock and roll, and I'm not going to go and tell the rock and roll how to play. He surely knows how to play. If anybody's going to tell me, he's going to tell me. Like I'm going to tell him how to play my way, he knows how to play his way.
Having said that, did you pick up anything from any of the players you played with?
I pick up something from everybody.
Yeah.
When they come up on the stage here, there isn't a person that I don't learn from.
Right.
Whether it's right or wrong, I learn something, what not to do or what to do. And I think that's terribly important. But the most important thing is that you have a chance to see what the people in the audience think. And I can see it like they see it because I'm not playing, they're playing. They're up there performing, and I get a chance to judge along with the people. So I can become one of them. And that's an important part. Only wouldn't it be great if us pros could be a layman and hear it the way they hear it, because they're the ones that make it a hit. They're our jury.
Right.
Okay, so right. When I make a record, when I get serious and make a record, and I'm producing that record, I don't produce that record to educate the public. I'm there to please the public and give them what they wish to hear.
That's fantastic, Les. Well, I think it's time to wrap up. They need to get this room ready, and you've got a couple of shows tonight.
Hello there. Well, I still have my guitar hanging around my neck, and my wife, Mary.
Hi.
And my invention, the Les Pulverizer, I have that on the floor.
Oh, you're not going to start fooling around with that thing again, are you?
Oh, it's sure rough to be sitting around here with just one microphone, trying to be a normal individual, one guitar.
Come on, Les, grab a guitar.
Somewhere there's music. Famous soon, somewhere there's heaven, by the moon, there is no moon above, and love is fine.
that it's the Les Pulverizer and not the Mary Porterizer? I've just made a decision. I'm through with electronics. No more electrical gadgets for me.
Really?
Yep.
And so concludes my interview with Mr. Les Paul. This episode of Culture Catch was brought to you by Final Draft, the industry standard number one selling script writing software for movies, television, and stage plays. And now Final Draft AV, the only multi-column script writing software for podcasts, videocasts, commercials, TV shorts, documentaries, you name it. And our friends at WebHSP. For all of your web hosting needs, it's webhsp.com. We'll see you soon. Converge is the word.